Hello, gang. Weekside Podcast, Playoff Edition. Jenny Frentis is here. I'm Connor Rohr. And, we're not going to be talking a whole lot about the playoffs, oddly, because the coaching cycle, carousel, whatever you want to call it, went absolutely crazy. And we're recording this on Tuesday, the 7th. So you have just sort of a concept of what's going on here. The Panthers have made a hire. The Giants have made a hire. The Browns are the only team left as of the recording of this podcast that has not chosen their next head coaching candidate. We're going to get into all that. We're going to get into where we're headed this weekend for the divisional round of the playoffs. But Jenny, I think merits conversation immediately, right, is that Matt Rhule was hired by the Carolina Panthers. Joe Judge was hired by the New York Giants. That leaves four minority coaches as head coaching candidates, barring something going on with Cleveland. Maybe Robert Saleh, Eric Bieniemy. There are some people that were in the mix. It looks like another really bad year for the Rooney Rhule process as a whole. And I think this is something that, with the Super Bowl coming up and Roger Goodell speaking publicly again, is something that he's certainly going to have to answer for after bringing it up at last year's Super Bowl press conference. Like, he had a plan to fix this. It seems like whatever plan is in motion has not taken hold immediately, because this is another kind of bleak cycle, I think, for minority coaching candidates.
Yeah, last year was particularly notable because five of the eight head coaches fired last season were non-white coaches, and then just one non-white coach was hired, Brian Flores. And so if it stands with Rivera, that'll be just three non-white coaches hired over the last 3 years, I believe, if Rivera is the only non-white coach hired in this cycle. So clearly there's a big problem to fix, but I do think, any plan in place, probably you wouldn't see the impact of it immediately. I think there's a lot of problems, with advancement of coaches through the pipeline, of where you're looking for coaches and what roles, that there's this, stereotype of you need to be a quarterbacks coach or an offensive coordinator. Of course, that's not exclusive. Many of the coaches in this cycle don't fit that, but that does seem to be what has been popular over the last few years. And generally, that is fed by people who have played the quarterback position, which has been largely white over the last three decades. And so I think you sort of see people getting pushed or pigeonholed into roles, and offensive coordinators not coming from tight ends coaches or running backs coaches or other positions on the field. So I think an examination is necessary of figuring out lower on the pipeline of getting assistant coaches to coordinator roles, and then those coordinators can become head coaches. But I think underlying it all is really the fact that majority of owners in the league are white, and we have this, people hire what they're comfortable yep. with. And I think that is, those kind of entrenched racial biases are really affecting the process.
I think that they're sliding towards, like, it's almost like a political campaign where maybe it's not the most, based in truth fact, but it's the one that sticks, right? It's something that sticks in your mind and is hard for people to shake, without kind of going too deep into it. And I think there are two kind of big optical issues with this cycle in particular. I mean, a lot of people have brought up correctly that, Jim Caldwell was let go in Detroit, and still in the time that he was there in one season had more wins than Matt Patricia has accumulated in his time there. And I think that is on one side. And on the other side, Joe Judge, who was just hired by the Giants, has never called any plays. And isn't that sort of the one thing that everyone uses as a knock against Eric Bieniemy, despite the fact that all of Andy Reid's other offensive coordinators have been hired and, brought into other jobs? And I just think it's one of those things where, nuance aside, whatever you want to say to combat that, they're starting to stack up against the NFL, and they're very difficult sort of optical problems for them to sidestep.
Yeah, and what is the solution? People have mentioned a Rooney Rhule for interviewing for coordinator jobs. Of course, the Rooney Rhule is both good and bad. It expands the search for some owners who might not have considered candidates outside of people who look like them. But at the same time, there are a lot of minority coaches that don't like the Rooney Rhule because you feel like you're a token interview. I really think, you know, I do think there's that gap from the position coach to the coordinator level. So I do think there could be some value in a Rooney Rule at that level. But again, like, we face this issue in all aspects of society. How do you overcome and change entrenched racial biases with people might not even realize, right? It's their own blind spot that they have. And, you know, the judge hire, we'll get to it a little bit later. I mean, I actually, like, that is like a team that's, maybe it doesn't work, but at least they're thinking outside of the box a little bit. Like, at least it's considering that you can be a leader and come from a different pipeline than, you know, calling the offensive plays. So I think, you know, we always say, you know, head coach hires, we wish that there would be a little bit of a shakeup in how teams look at them. And it's hard to pick out any one situation and say, hey, this particular hire is a reflection of the fact that the Rooney Rule doesn't work. But collectively, over the past few years, there clearly has been a failure.
Yeah. I think the one thing about, you know, I think 2 years ago, what the Raiders did, expressly admitting that for the last 3 years that they wanted to hire John Gruden and bulldozing over the Rooney Rule, is on one side of the issue. You could argue that maybe Dallas did that a little bit with Mike McCarthy this year, even though they did satisfy the rule and they did talk to Marvin Lewis for the vacancy. But I don't think we had as egregious of a violation. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I've talked to Tony Dungy about this. Nobody seems to be just inhabiting the spirit of the rule, which is to stop and to think about what's going on and to consider all of your options. And we'll get to the rule hire too, but this was a one-day meeting in Waco that turned out to be essentially like a bidding war for this guy to not let him leave the meeting room. And how much are you really thinking about, you know, all the other candidates that you'd interviewed at that moment? How much are you weighing all the options on your plate? And I don't know, it just seems like nobody is embodying the spirit of the rule that, you know, the person who created it will tell you got him Mike Tomlin, who's one of the best coaches in the NFL.
And I think this is where the speed of the hiring cycle really works against that happening, because teams are just, you think you like a guy, if he leaves the building, he'll go somewhere else. And I don't know the right way to fix that, but like, if there was like a, you know, like we see in free agency, you know, a tampering window or tampering something. Window, of course, yeah. That's been a sham as well. So all of these, any kind of artificial window you would put in place ends up becoming a sham. So maybe that's not the right thing. But it's just so hard because you have to make a decision so quickly. And so you just say, hey, I'm going to not open my mind to where a good head coach might come from. You meet someone you're comfortable with and you've got to get the deal done right there. And I don't think that helps either.
We'll see. I mean, like you said, at least at the recording of this podcast, the Cleveland Browns still have yet to make a hire, maybe with no pressure on them anywhere else. And they can kind of take their time and maybe embody that spirit and think about the rule a little bit. And we'll see. But we have a lot to get to. Like I said, we'll break down all the coaching hires. We'll talk a little bit about the playoffs this weekend. We have our normal segments. And Jenny, the Bachelor is back. I'm very excited. We're going to add a little bit of Bachelor talk here to the end of the show. Got some good NFL comparisons there. I've got a dry sense of humor, but I promise you the rest of the show is going to be very exciting. We'll be back after this. All right, let's get to the news, Jenny. What do we got here at number one?
The Carolina Panthers on Tuesday signed former Baylor head coach Matt Rhule to a 7-year deal that could be worth as much as $70 million with incentives, blowing the lid off both conventional decision-making and conventional coaching salaries. Except if you're John Gruden.
Oh.
With Lincoln Riley sitting out of the dance, Rhule felt like the ultimate darling of the cycle. What do you make of this major swing from first-time coach hirer David Tepper?
That's an interesting thing on his resume, like hedge fund manager and now coach hirer.
Right.
He can say that now.
Right. Well, I think it's, on paper, it looks like a good hire. Mm-hmm. He's turned around two college programs. I think there's always a difference between college and the NFL, so you're always projecting on some level. But you're right. He did emerge as the hot candidate in this cycle that was outside of the NFL realm.
I think that the length of the contract is one of those things that, It's one-upping the Kyle Shanahan, John Lynch deal, where 6 years felt abnormally long at this point, and now 7 years. And I guess that is your out front commitment to saying, hey, no matter how weird or bad this gets in the first 2 years, we're really sticking with this. And I think that regardless of how it works out, I do think it is good that the owner is giving himself a long view, because that's how college hires seem to fail traditionally, right? Is that they don't have success in the first year because they're acclimating to the league and kind of how things work and just the stuff that people don't tell you and don't want you to know. And after that, maybe they hit the ground running, but they just don't have enough time to turn around. 7 years is enough time to figure it out.
Yeah, I think that's encouraging. I'm surprised a little bit that I didn't think the Panthers job was high on my list of available openings. Mm-hmm. I think the quarterback uncertainty is a big question mark. Now, of course, you always hear the stories of when Frank Reich interviewed for the Colts job, he didn't ask about Luck's health. He wanted the job regardless. So, you know, there's obviously other parts to a roster, and there's a lot of ways to address that position. But I thought it was lower on the list among the openings because of that.
What was your number one? I think we talked about this, right?
Well, I thought that the Giants was a pretty good situation. Yeah. I mean, the one drawback there, of course, is Gettleman. But if you're a candidate that has a lot of pull and that they really wanted, you know, maybe you could have made a power. Like, you know, if someone was interviewing for the job and they were considering the openings and, you know, I don't know, maybe you could make some demands in that area, but
I think that the Panthers hire is interesting because the more that we blend NFL and college, and maybe the more that every year we get one of these Matt Rules that comes up and becomes this person that you feel like you have, I think one of the interesting practices that Tepper is doing, and we saw the Eagles do it with Chip Kelly and a couple times, where you're making investments almost like a college is in a college head coach. Like, you know, it's the NFL equivalent of agreeing to building a new facility, right? Like, we're going to invest in sports science. We're going to invest in whatever it is that you do at college with an unlimited blank check budget. We're going to help bring it to the NFL. And at the worst, I don't think that this can be bad for players, right? You know, and maybe it's a more accommodating environment for players. You know, teams are at least going to be forced to spend more of their, you know, gigantic profits on improving the product and not just, you know, assuming that, hey, I'm one of these 32 teams, so I'm just going to get one of these guys by default anyway.
And this was Tepper's chance really to make a mark on the program. As you mentioned, it's his first time hiring a head coach. This is his way of saying, this is where I want this team to go. And he did well this hiring cycle. This was a coveted candidate. He was able to land him. So however the move works out, it does speak well to him that he was able to land a top candidate, even with a lot of uncertainties on that roster.
When in the summer, you've joined it a couple times. We do a podcast where we have a few adult beverages and we watch movies. And you had said that when you watch a movie, sometimes there's a feeling of you being trapped that you don't like because it's a 2-hour commitment, right? And that, you know, it's hard to get out of there. And the odd sort of theme that is emerging here in this head coaching cycle, Mike McCarthy was at Jerry Jones's house and he didn't want him to leave. Matt Rhule's in this meeting room with David Tepper and he doesn't want him to leave. As a person who doesn't like to be trapped, would that be weird if you were courted as a head coaching candidate and they're like, Jenny, you can't leave this room until you agree to sign this?
I think if they were giving me $70 million, I would find a way to overcome this fear of mine, Connor.
So that's the secret,
that's
ultimately.
That's the secret, ultimately.
Okay. Good to know for the next season of that podcast. So this, I think, is interesting. Our second news topic, in the immediate aftermath of the Rhule hire, this was about, I would say, an hour after the news broke that he was signing with the Panthers. The New York Giants announced their pact with special teams coordinator and 1-year wide receivers coach Joe Judge of the Patriots. They were the only team to bring him in this cycle. And I think in the moment, there were many hurried tweets, some of them with kind of conflicting information that, you know, this was the guy that they wanted all along. They didn't actually want Matt Rhule. Matt Rhule was one of many people that they were interested in. And the timing of this should not be read into in any way, shape, or form. Is they just agreed to terms. And, you know, Matt Rhule picking the Panthers had nothing to do with this. I don't know how much I buy that. I think they liked Matt Rhule. I think, you know, NFL Network eventually reported that Rhule called them and said, hey, here's the deal. Do you guys want to match this? And then I'll get on the plane. And they said no. So I don't know. I mean, what do you think of Joe Judge? And also, do you think that he was their first choice?
The optics are bad for the Giants because of the timing, because of the fact that Matt Rhule was born in New York City and, you know, didn't come and meet with the team from his hometown. I mean, there's all of these things. And of course, you know, then the Judge hiring coming out right after the Rhule hiring as if to say, no, 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 like, and let's just fix this. I mean, it smacks a little bit of like the narrative that like the Ravens were the only team in the league that identified Lamar Jackson when the reality is they also drafted a backup tight end before him in the first round. So they didn't know for sure that he was going to become what he's become because if so, they would have drafted him at 16 or wherever their first pick was in that round, right? So, I mean, so it does, I mean, but of course you get, you're making the hire, you want to get the narrative out there that this was your first pick all along. Now, I, you know, I don't actually have a problem with the pick. I mean,
I don't at all.
All I can say about it is I don't really have a great feel for how it will work, and I don't know that the Giants know for sure either, because again, like, you're making a big projection here. But I do like the idea that, like, okay, you're as we mentioned earlier, kind of thinking outside the box a little bit. You're, you know, considering that a leader can come from anywhere on a team. You know, I'm sure Belichick gave a strong reference. I'm sure Nick Saban gave a strong reference. Those are two people that the Giants value highly. So, you know, that doesn't mean anything, obviously, because we've seen plenty of coaches from the Belichick tree fail. So maybe it's really not outside that outside the box. You're just getting another Belichick assistant. But I do like the idea that, like, a good coach can come from anywhere on the roster and that your experience leading special teams, which, Connor, this is really in your wheelhouse here, but, you know, players from all across the roster, bottom of the roster players, bringing out the best in everyone. I mean, Brian Flores is looking like a successful hire from the Belichick tree, and he had experience on special teams. You know, he worked with Matthew Slater and helped him become this special teams ace that he is. So, you know, we're going to get to, you know, obviously Harbaugh and then Dave Tobe, Connor, who hasn't had a head coach job but has been hired several times.
Yeah.
Or has been interviewed, excuse me.
So in doing reporting for this podcast, I did contact the president of the Dave Tobe Society for comment. It was me. we're not going to talk at this time. I don't think it's the right time.
It's a difficult time?
I think it's bittersweet.
Okay.
I think if you're looking for the guy, he's been the guy. I think ESPN released, they do their advanced special teams metrics, and we're way in the weeds now. I acknowledge that, but that we've touched the nerve with the Tobe thing, so I have to feel this out. For those of you who don't know, I've advocated for Dave Tobe to be a head coach for like the last four seasons. I think he's going to be an excellent head coach at some point, but he just had his worst season as a special teams coordinator according to their metrics in his entire time as a special teams coordinator. And guess what place he finished in?
Third.
Ninth.
Oh,
your worst season ever was the ninth best special teams unit in the NFL.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. All right. No, it's a convincing case. I think there's a lot of evidence. You know, I think the one risk for the Giants, we talked a couple weeks ago that like they can't afford to miss this hire.
Yeah.
They missed on Ben McAdoo, first-time head coach. They missed on Shurmur, second-time head coach. So what is the right formula? What is a so-called safe hire? And the reality is, there isn't really a safe hire. So I guess they liked a guy and that's what they went with. But yeah, I mean, the optics with the Rhule situation and the timing of it are bad and certainly do not help to offset this, you know, there's a lot of questions swirling around the Giants facility, right?
Yeah.
For keeping Dave Gettleman and some of the decisions they've made and the fact that they've now overturned coaches twice, you know, two coaches in the last four seasons and they're moving on to their third. So I don't know that this necessarily answers those, but, you know, I think it's an interesting decision. And, you know, I think he could be a very good head coach.
Exactly. Check mark in the column of way to not just hire Pat Shurmur again, basically. Right. You know, and there were certainly opportunities to do exactly that. And there was four or five of the same kind of offensive coordinator of the moment that you could have hired and used the excuse that this is good for Daniel Jones and just kind of plodded along on your path. And you didn't. I mean, I think that's good. The bad is that this team is one hire away from, and I think you and I kind of have a unique insight on this because we live in the market and we understand the uniqueness of the market. I think they're one bad hire away from becoming the Knicks or the, I don't know, what are similarly dysfunctional New York teams. I mean, not the Jets, because I don't think they're ever going to go there.
The Mets,
you know, maybe something like that, where it's a team that wins championships from now and then, but is mostly defined in the moment by instability and organizational failure, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably a ways from that, but you're right in the reputation has taken a big hit, and it's a far way away from, you know, the respect that it had for much of the earlier part of this millennium.
Here's what I want to hear, though, because you and I just ran down every reason why you would hire a special teams coordinator, right? Give me something beyond that. I'm going to need something beyond that. Like, every person that Belichick hires is smart. He hires smart people. Everyone that Belichick hires works hard. You know, they work long hours. This is every single person that we've read about that has come from this tree. I need something else here. Like, what has he done that's like that in the interview that made you say, holy smokes, like, this guy's going to be great for the entire team?
Well, that's where I think they need a good PR strategy. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about, like, Gettleman not doing himself any favors with his public comments.
Yeah.
And I think in this situation, they've got to make sure that they clearly convey exactly what you just said, beyond, oh my gosh, he's got this Belichick and Saban tie. What makes him individually special and what makes you convinced that he will succeed? One of the biggest questions he'll face is, you know, who, if you're hiring, let me back up a second. We talked before, what direction will the Giants go? Because now twice they've hired offensive-minded guys, play callers that failed, right? Mm-hmm. So they've gone with a slightly different direction. But the problem when you hire a special teams coach is then, is the offensive coordinator good? And then if he's too good, you could lose him. And then do you have more turnover on that side?
Yeah.
So I think that is always the question when you're developing a quarterback. And that's why a lot of teams go with the play-calling head coach, because they figure that at least they know that he'll stay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what Gettleman cannot do this time, right, is come out with the equivalent of, I watched him for three series at the Senior Bowl.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
Like, there has to be, when he was in, I don't know, I mean, you know, whatever, when he was coaching at Mississippi State, there was a group of Bulldogs that were trying to ford a river, and he put the entire, you know, the ship was broken and he fixed it and he pushed it, you know, something like that. That's kind of what I'm, what I think is necessary. But anyway, another head coaching hire we got to get to now.
All right. Topic number three. The Dallas Cowboys hired former Packers head coach Mike McCarthy earlier this week to be their new head coach, replacing Jason Garrett, who had been the team's head coach since 1987. All right. I just was
a good one.
It seemed, you know, it seemed accurate. So
that was a good one.
Jones is clearly spelling out his desperation to win a title with this hire. But is Mike McCarthy the coach who can deliver on those high expectations?
What do you think? I think he is betting on this. There's two gambles you can make. You can either make the Matt Rule gamble and gamble that it's sort of the high risk, high reward, that a great college coach can become a great pro coach and transform your program. Or you're betting that a once great head coach is willing to change. And I think both of those carry with it a certain amount of risk.
Yeah, I'm sure part of the Cowboys process was learning what McCarthy learned in this last year of self-reflection. What did he do? How did he try to get better? I think coach like Adam Gase has come up a lot. Like, would a year off have been good for him so that he could reevaluate? You know, a year off away from the game humbles you a little bit, and it does allow for self-reflection. I always feel like that's the way to go. Of course, the risk then is, do you ever get a chance again?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, after McCarthy didn't take a job in the last cycle, it was fair to wonder if he'd go the way of, like, Brian Billick and never get another opportunity. So I think he's obviously done enough in the last year to show teams that he has adapted, that he's learned, that he'll have a slightly different approach. And, of course, he had success in Green Bay. So it was interesting that the narrative the last few seasons in Green Bay and the criticism that came his way, I think, really put a dent in the success that he had leading the Packers to a Super Bowl and success for many years with Rodgers. Like, it was almost like that was a distant memory. So I think Jones is hiring based on that experience and also based on the ability to learn from things that might have gone wrong.
If there is such a thing as a safe hire, this was probably the safest one you could have made this year, I would guess, right?
Yeah, just a wealth of experience dealing with a superstar quarterback, leading a team to a Super Bowl. Absolutely.
I posed this question on Twitter, and I'd be interested to get your take. So he had to stay at Jerry Jones's house the night before, and then in the morning, I think the deal was finalized. And I think the quote that Adam Schefter tweeted was, "Once you stay at Jerry's house, he gets his man," or something like that. If that happened, like, I always wonder, like, if you're the head coach and you're staying at the owner's house, is your ultimate inclination to wake up earlier than the owner and to be like at his breakfast table breaking down film because you want to show him that this is what you do normally? Or are you trying to be a good house guest and be just a good person and get the job? In which case, you know, whenever I'm staying at someone's house, I kind of just like stay in the bedroom until I hear them wake up, and then I act like I had a restful night's sleep and then come down and join, you know, the party.
Maybe there's some middle ground here. Maybe you wait till you hear some stirring in the kitchen and then you burst in, arms full of Surface tablet and some some coaching manuals, and be like, "Yeah, I was just catching up on some morning reading, got a few good hours
that's
in."
That's the move.
Yeah, that's it. And then say like, "Oh, I'm really hungry for breakfast, really worked up an appetite." And you probably like pick some coach that you know Jerry loves, and you come in with his like book or something.
If it was Belichick,
which, okay, this analogy is spun off the rails because Belichick isn't hiring. But like, you know, you walk in with, you make some Paul Brown analogy, or like, you know what I mean? Like, you gotta hit the sweet spot a little.
Yeah, God. And here I thought there was only like, you know, one or two answers, and then you come in with the perfect answer. I mean, there is no yes and no. That's it. I mean, that's the one. Man, that was good. I don't know. I would have probably gotten up at like 4:30. You know what? Our colleague Mitch Goldich brought up an interesting fourth option, which was to get up before the owner and to get your workout in, so that when he wakes up, you are already like engaged and like sweaty and just, I don't know what that does to the aesthetic in that situation, but just ready to go. I don't know. And that's just another option.
Okay. And then maybe make a pot of coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A friend recently said that she learned from Martha Stewart that the secret to a good pot of coffee is a pinch of nutmeg and a pinch of salt.
No kidding.
But she told this to another friend of ours who then dumped like an entire tablespoon of salt in the coffee grounds, and that didn't work out. So if you're going to go that route, be careful.
So you put it in the coffee grounds.
I guess so. Like just a sprinkle though, not a tablespoon.
Interesting.
Shout out to Charlotte.
Wow. And then this is the last one because this is far off the rails, but you know, I would be worried about staying at a rich person's house. They definitely have a coffee maker that I don't know how to use.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I'm thinking of like us humble people that have like the $20 Mr. Coffee pot.
I have a $20. Yeah. It's like Saboli or something.
Okay. Yeah. I've got the like, yeah. That's what I'm thinking
coffee.
Of. Well, that would, yeah. So you're right. Maybe skip the coffee.
Do you make the, like if you're staying at someone's house and you're up first, I guess it depends on how well you know them, but would you just make the coffee?
Probably not.
No.
That seems a little bold.
You would wait for them to ask you to make the coffee.
It's very fraught staying at a person's house, especially when you don't know very well.
It terrifies me.
Yeah.
The entire process, which blows, like this is the third year in a row that we've had like sleepover stories.
Absolutely.
In the coaching cycle.
It's
Vic
very
Fangio, Mike Munchak slept over John Elway's house, like, and they just talk about it like it's this normal thing. And I guess maybe since it's a nomadic life, you're used to sleeping on couches and, you know, and doing that for a large period of your time. But so is journalism. And it freaks me out every time I have to do it.
It's making me panic just thinking about
right.
it.
Okay. So let's move on then with news item number four. Joe Judge is obviously leaving the Patriots. The Cleveland Browns have requested an interview with Josh McDaniels. Perhaps he is their candidate of choice there. The tides of change seem to be washing upon Foxborough. Does that go for the quarterback position as well? Or do we think that the murkiness surrounding Tom Brady's future is simply the kind of blather that we fill the void with when in reality there's just a bunch of adults trying to make important life decisions and there's nothing to say right now?
I do think it's blather right now for the reason that I don't know that anybody knows the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's a worthwhile conversation on the other hand, in the sense that there are a lot of possibilities right mm-hmm. now. I was in Foxborough this past weekend, and I think you really just get the vibe that nothing has been determined, that they were trying to get through the season, that there are a lot of factors at play. As you mentioned, McDaniel's future, you know, there's a lot of changes that could go on with the Patriots, you know, Caserio, members of their front office who are no longer under contract. You know, there's a number of core players who are going to be free agents in addition to Tom Brady, but Brady will be a free agent for the first time in his 20-year career, and that gives him some freedom and flexibility. On the other hand, Connor, it's not entirely in his hands. Like,
right.
There's the factor of, okay, obviously the Krafts want Brady back, but does Belichick want Brady back? Will they be able to agree to terms? If he looks elsewhere, what other teams are interested in and at what price? Are there how many teams will have vacancies at the quarterback position and would be able to financially and, you know, commit to bringing someone like Brady in? So there's a lot of factors at play here. And so I saw a lot of discussion of Brady kind of being at peace for once this decision's in his hands. And that's partly true, but it's also partly out of his hands.
It's weird because for the first time in his life, he could be wooed.
Right.
There could be some wooing.
And first time in his football life.
True.
First time in his football. I mean, recruiting to college, I guess. Although, you know.
Yeah, there's probably bit of wooing there. Yeah.
Yes, in the NFL career.
One would assume in his personal life, he was the one that had to do the wooing, I would guess. I don't know. I'm not an expert on that. But
yeah, I don't want to speculate on on romantic lives. But in football, yes.
In football, okay. Yeah. Like, imagine if, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean, everyone has said the Chargers because that's just he has a house there and they're desperate for attention and that's just mm-hmm. kind of, you know, the thing. But like, I don't know, what if them or the Bears or any of these teams pick him up at the airport in a limo and take him to their facility and show him all the great things he's done, which mm-hmm. we know Bill Belichick just isn't one to do. He wants to criticize him and he wants to get on him and he wants to rile up Tommy so he plays better. And what if finally it's like, we want you and we're going to pay more than any other quarterback to have you. You're necessary here for everything. I wonder what that does to somebody, you know?
Right. It'll be a new experience for him if that's the case. You mentioned, two teams. You know, the Bears obviously have missed on the Trubisky pick. The Chargers, in all likelihood, will move on from Rivers, and so he'll have options there. So they have to figure out which direction they want to go in. But I think the question becomes, what do you think Tom Brady wants at this juncture? People have said he's not going to end his career on a pick six. And like, I'm not sure that I'm a person that like gets caught up in like what the ending looks like.
Joe
like,
Montana ended his career on an interception.
Exactly. Yeah. Favre. Like, I think we get too caught up in the ending. But if he's going to continue to play, is it being resolute that he will play till age 45? Is it winning another championship away from the Patriots to prove that he can do it on his own? Is it winning another championship with the Patriots? So I think, and maybe he doesn't know the answer to any of those questions, like what he's looking for in the final chapter of his career.
You know, it's amazing for people of that status and that level. I mean, our old boss, Peter King, visited Brady and he's got a home in Montana, among other places, and he had time to reflect there and make a decision. I could probably make a good life decision if I could disappear to like Jackson Hole for 5 days in a really nice place and clear my mind. But, you know, I don't know. Just not an option for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of unfair to expect that some kind of decision would have been made at this point because you're trying to get through the season. He was dealing with a lot of injuries, which require a lot of treatment mm-hmm. time. You know, you're trying to get all these young offensive players who don't know the system very well or new offensive players on board. And so I just think there wasn't a lot of time to even consider. Like, you know, people talk about like, well, how do you put that away and not think about it? I think it's pretty easy to put it away when like every day, every minute of every day is like devoted to a singular task, right? Like you're totally consumed. Like you don't actually have the time to think about those other things. So now he has the time. The season ending this early has given him a lot of time. And I do think it's going to be a fascinating spring for the Patriots.
Here's one thing that I can't get past that I think is fascinating about all this. And I think someone brought up the Belichick quote about, you know, he often laments after winning the Super Bowl that, oh, it stinks because we're 5 weeks behind on our preparation for, you know, the upcoming season. So how do you reconcile, you know, if this guy is such a controlling person that needs everything planned out, to not know who your starting quarterback is going to be, or at least who you think he's going to be, is stunning to me.
My prediction is that he'll stay in New England. Mm-hmm. Tony Romo said as much on the CBS broadcast.
That was interesting. Yeah.
Now, Chris Collinsworth went the other way the next day and said the Chargers, as if, you know, he threw that one out. But I just think the likeliest option is that Brady stays in New England. I think the Crafts will work hard to make it happen, but I think Brady has to want that, and I think Bill has to want that.
I want him in Chicago.
Wow.
I really do.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. What, you think the you know, he'd want to play with the defense there?
Play with the defense there, and maybe Matt Nagy, and like kind of a different kind of highly touted play caller. And I think that the Bears could sell it because they're like, here's this floundering rookie that is in need of some confidence. Well, here's the best quarterback of all time. Watch him play for a season and then build yourself up and then reemerge from the cocoon more Tom Brady-esque the year after that.
Interesting. All right. On that note, we'll move on to the last topic. Hey, there are playoffs this weekend. I, Jenny Rentis, will be in Baltimore to see the Ravens take on the Tennessee Titans. Connor will be in Kansas City to see the Chiefs welcome the Houston Texans. Let's talk about that. So we're AFC heavy. We're like Jade Roper making her DraftKings picks and going with all the AFC quarterbacks while her husband Tanner went with all the NFC. So we're AFC here. We're,
yes.
Jade won $1 million. Hopefully that is also in our future.
Yes.
Okay, so for me in Baltimore, I think the most interesting thing is just thinking about where they were a year ago. Like, I was at their wild card game where they lost to the Chargers. Lamar Jackson struggled. At halftime, there was questions. Should they go back to Joe Flacco? And Harbaugh said he was asking people on the sideline, you know, and they ultimately stuck with Jackson, which didn't win the game, but I think it was an important outcome in building his long-term confidence and Harbaugh saying, you're my guy, and ultimately probably set the stage for this season. Then he had a whole offseason to rework the offense. Greg Roman was promoted to offensive coordinator. You know, James Urban has sent in a lot of the passing concepts, and so you have this MVP season. So I think it's just it's a pretty remarkable. This is why I voted for Harbaugh as coach of the year, because he's really committed to building a system around Lamar Jackson, creating this environment where his special talents have flourished. And, you know, so they're in a much different spot than they were a year ago. But can they translate into playoff success?
Yeah, I just think interesting. I don't think there's a defense that, now that New England is gone, I don't know who slows them down in the playoffs, right?
Yeah.
And maybe Tennessee is that team. I mean, mm-hmm. they've played well, and like Baltimore, they like to take time off the clock. They could put the Ravens in a position where they have to score faster than they used to. I don't know. That's going to be a really interesting game.
Yeah. All right. You're going to Arrowhead.
I am. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't been to Arrowhead in a long time. I'm very excited. I don't know. I think that they have this game, right? I mean, I think the Texans to me are just always one of those teams that's like, yeah, it was great to see you in the wild card round and we'll see you guys again next year, mm-hmm. right? I don't know. I mean, I think that they do some things well. I don't know if they defensively have the ability to match up with the Chiefs, even as whatever you want to call it, hobbled as they've been. And the Chiefs have gotten some time, too, to get over some of this stuff, too.
And they won largely because of Watson's heroics
yeah.
over a Bills team that made a lot of mistakes, right? That game could have easily gone either way. And Watson can do that. He gives you a chance to win any game. But you can't rely on his heroics to get
Correct.
You a win in every round. So I'm with you, Connor. I like the Chiefs in this game as well.
And you know what? I was probably the loudest critic out of anybody about this move, but Steve Spagnuolo's worked out really well there. Like, it is a much better defense, and it's a much different defense, and he's got some good ideas, and he's coached in big games, obviously. So I don't know. I'm interested to see their defense in particular.
That's the biggest difference from last year. You know, I think Mahomes had some injuries early in the season, obviously, and has kind of gotten back into form in the second half of the season, and the defense has gotten steadily better. So I do think, despite some of the early bumps, they're in a better spot right now than they were last year.
Yeah. So we have our final segments to go, plus the new Bachelor segment, which Jenny brilliantly named, what are we calling it?
Can I steal you for a second?
I love that. It's my favorite thing ever. So we'll get to all that in a minute, but we're just going to take one quick break. Okay, before we get to Can I Steal You for a Second, the greatest new segment on the Weak Side podcast, prediction time. Again, it's been a struggle this year. Everyone knows my track record, but I'm going to take my prediction for the Oracle and say that the Browns are not hiring Josh McDaniels for their head coaching job. And I think that McDaniels' return to New England will sort of start sowing the seeds of familiarity and everything will be fine there and back to normal. And I think that they're actually going to be committed to waiting this thing out, making an interesting decision. Hiring one of the hot sort of playoff coordinators, I think, is going to be their move.
I like that. I concur with you, Connor. I think that's a very good oracle. And I have to say, didn't you say a couple weeks ago there would be a hire that came out of the blue? And I think Joe Judge is that hire.
Yeah. I said that my qualification for it, which again, you know, made me upset because I wrote a list of 25 potential candidates. And I said, I guess the surprise would not be on that list. But I think that's more of a reflection of me not putting him on my list, Joe Judge, right?
I don't think so.
It's probably a bad job not putting him on the list.
I don't think so. Definitely it was a surprise hire. So I think you get a plus mark in
You'll
that
give
Oracle.
Me a half a point for
yes,
that?
Yes, I would like to give you a half a point.
Okay.
Maybe three quarters of a point.
All right.
Feeling
I like
generous,
that.
Benevolent.
Wow. That's great. So stretching off that, obviously every week we get Jenny's Frentis consensus, something we can all agree on. We're heading into the playoffs. I don't know. What do you got for us this week?
Really need to fix the All-Pro balance.
Yes.
This is my Frentis consensus.
Oh.
So, I voted, I guess, the last 3 years or so, and every year there's some kind of frustration with how we categorize the ballots. The ballots were redone a couple years ago to add the extra defensive back who could be a nickel defender, but they also created this flex position, which was a move to eliminate the fullback because many teams do not have fullbacks, and to add essentially a second or an additional offensive player that's a non-quarterback. The problem with the flex position is the definition of it can vary widely. Basically, it's your next best running back, receiver, or tight end who's not on your ballot. So this year, for instance, I put Christian McCaffrey as my first team running back, and then I was debating between Derrick Henry and Travis Kelce for my flex. It's a weird thing because on defense, the extra DB generally is somebody who it's a nickel defender, like generally a slot guy. So I voted for Tyrann Mathieu, who plays half of his snaps as safety, half of his snaps as a nickel defender. And I felt good about that because it helped me get an extra player who deserved to be on the ballot,
right?
So, you know, it helped me give Mathieu a vote in addition to the two all-pro safeties I was picking. So on offense, though, the flex is just too big of a... And I think because of that, we got the situation we had this year where Christian McCaffrey was first-team all-pro running back and first-team flex. And I think it's embarrassing. And the easiest fix, which Peter King and I were discussing this in the press box in Foxborough, the easiest fix would be if the person who gets the most flex votes is also on the ballot somewhere else, then you just move to the next one. And I do think that's the clearest thing. The other option would be to sharpen the definition of that, but I don't exactly know how you would. As I was voting, I said, is the flex position supposed to be somebody who is in a hybrid role? And the answer I got back was no, it's just, you know, running back, tight end, wide receiver, like your next best one. So I think a lot of people I think the reason McCaffrey ended up as a flex for people was trying to fit in a hybrid player. And then people went with Derrick Henry, who was the rushing title winner, as their first team All-Pro running back. The reason I didn't do that was I thought Christian McCaffrey should be the first team All-Pro running back.
Right.
So I figured I would take care of the flex later. In any event, needs to be some streamlining to avoid this mistake. We also have the perennial issue, which Andy Benoit and I always bang the table about, is the linebacker edge situation.
Yes.
There's only two edge players who make All-Pro, but there's three linebackers. And they... leave it to teams to say where a player can be designated. So if you have a guy who plays a lot on the edge and you're a team PR person, you would want him to be voted in the linebacker category because there's a better chance that he would stand out among the inside linebackers in terms of things like sack total. And also because there's three linebacker spots and there's only two edge spots. So there's a big inconsistency there, and it allows teams to kind of play the odds and say, hey, like Kyle Van Noy can be a linebacker. Which, in many reality, Kyle Van Noy plays edge, but I put Van Noy as a linebacker on my ballot because that's what I was instructed to do. So I think there's a lot of ways in which the ballot can be cleaned up a little bit, and maybe this is a rant that only I care about,
no.
But I don't think anyone wants to see the same player at two spots because all pros shape legacies. They're on your resume. It really is an important part of a player's legacy, as opposed to the Pro Bowl, which we all know is kind of haphazard. But all pro does mean something, and I think our goal should be to get as many of the top players on the roster as possible. So having a repeat just really muddies the whole process.
It's a great point. I mean, I think Khalil Mack was the first time that we realized a couple years ago, right, that we need to evolve with the game in the voting, mm-hmm. in the voting process. And yeah, I mean, you're right. Every year there seems to be one person that everyone's like, well, what is going on here? But modernize, Jenny.
Modernize.
We have to modernize. Right. That's a consensus I think we can all get on the
modernize board. Analytics, you know, throw it out there, Connor.
All right, Jenny, can I steal you for a second? Because The Bachelor premiered last night. Peter is getting his chance to mend the heart that Hannah B. stomped on so viciously last season when she eventually chose her fake husband, Jed, who was lying about everything. Bad musician, too.
Terrible all around.
Dog food jingle writer, Jed. And so I don't know. There was a 3-hour premiere last night, which was
difficult
daunting.
To get through. Daunting.
Yeah, it was as long as The Irishman on Netflix, but for some reason,
that really puts it
not,
in context.
The Irishman's a little bit longer.
Okay.
I think The Irishman's like 3.5 hours.
Okay.
But I mean,
this
was longer than most feature films, you know. But my immediate takeaway, and I think I'm going to get crushed for saying this. I have two kind of immediate takeaways. One, I fear Peter cannot carry a season. I'm mm-hmm. a little bit worried about that. I don't know about the strength of his personality. And two, I loved the gimmick of bringing back Hannah B. to try to rekindle that love. They admitted that they cared about each other. But I was pounding the table last night and saying, Peter, if you love her, go get her. You know, she's right there. Make a play for it. But all along, it was just, why didn't you call me? You live 20 minutes away. And Hannah, good for her, said, you know what, Peter, you didn't call me either. You know?
She did say that.
Didn't call me either. So make a play, Peter. This is your TV show. You can do it right now. Invite her back to the house and make her fight it out.
Wow. I need to offer a mea culpa to Connor because yesterday in the office, I just was like, you know, this Canna thing, she's just going to come and wish him good luck and leave. And so here I am watching the show and feeling all smug. Be like, Connor's not a veteran Bachelor watcher. You know, he doesn't know how this works. She comes, she gives him back the wings. And of course, she's on her merry way. So I'm like, see, Connor, this is how it works. I didn't foresee that homegirl was going to be back in like the group date scene. And then, first of all, I was trapped by the 3 hours and I fast forwarded through much of the middle. So I had to get to the end before today's show. So I see her crying in the dressing room with Peter. Now, this is more drama than I thought. The previews, I thought it was just, you know, come, good luck, bye, because that often happens with other contestants. But this is a lot, and it's going to turn into something that Peter's going to have to explain to his other contestants.
Yeah.
Because if they, you know, they'll watch that scene now, and if he's engaged to somebody, they would not be happy by that. Because he clearly is a man who is not ready to be dating 30 other women. Like, he clearly needs to resolve his feelings for Hannah and then come on the show in another season. But that's not where they're at right now.
I know this is no longer about finding love. This just seems to be a television spectacle.
You know, Connor, this is a little bit like the head coach hiring cycle.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
It's just so fast, and like, you got to keep pace and you got to make snap decisions, and you don't get to fully explore what you might have with any one candidate.
And Peter is like one of the McVay assistants, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, boy, I don't know about this. This seemed like a good idea at the time, and now we're here and we're a little nervous that he might actually be able to to do this on his own. One thing I noticed about...
That's great. That's great, Connor.
One thing that like tripped me up last night, and I liked that because you started about 40 minutes behind me, and so I had like a series of tweets about it, and I liked like 40 minutes later, you started liking the ones like as you saw them going by, which made me feel very good about. I'm new to Bachelor tweeting, so I felt good about it. My engagement was not exactly what I had hoped, but I feel like I had the right idea, mostly, tweeting about the show. But the thing that startled me the most, and if I'm Peter, is an immediate thing. I could have cut half the contestants out yesterday. When you're coming out of the limo, why are you doing an airplane bit? Like, everybody else is going to do an airplane bit. Like,
totally.
Were you sitting there being like, no, I'm going to be the only one that does an airplane bit? And then in a mediocre airplane bit, because the one woman actually got waved in by the pilot, by the air traffic control. Smart. I thought that was a smart move, a cute thing, something he's going to remember. Everybody else was just like, you know, there was 9 flight attendants. He's not going to be amused by that the third or fourth time. You know, if you're a contestant on the show, do a little bit of research, you know, come on.
I do think the producers have input on what their opening routine is, and they probably teed that up.
To do the montage of, I'm a flight attendant,
yes,
I'm a flight attendant.
Yes, and okay. I also noticed, because this was a 3-hour premiere, and there was not just the first night, but then the first set of dates, so the introductions were a little more jammed. Like, they generally spend more time, and you see more of the intro, so mm-hmm. I do think there were more non-flight related intros that we didn't see, but I was actually pretty relieved not to see all of the intros, because, like... The names don't stick with you anyway, and it becomes kind of a meaningless part of the season. But one interesting thing about that is, do you think, like, when they're editing this, they know who the winner is? So, like, do you think that they're, of course, going to show the intro, the first interaction between Peter and the winner? So I believe that the winner has got to be one of the intros that they show. It's not going to be a person they skipped over.
That's a great point.
So we probably already know, I don't know how many intros did they show. I mean, it was a large percentage of it, probably 15 to 20, but you can at least, you know.
That's a great point.
Right? Yeah.
I feel like this is only my second season, so I'm not used to the directions that they try to take you in emotionally. I feel like the woman that he knows previously from meeting in the hotel lobby is a red herring. I feel like that's something that they're like, no, it's going to be her. And then, whoa, at some minute, they're just going to yank her out.
Uh-huh.
I feel like that's a red herring. I feel like... like, there were so many people in The Bachelorette last year where I was just like, oh, this is a slam dunk. Like, you know, you work with underprivileged, you know, you're just like the golden human being. And then they end up just kicking them all out, you know, at the end, which I was very surprised
about. You realize it just comes down to what the opening scenes were of this season, which was like, oh, my God, Peter is delicious.
Yes.
So that works both ways.
I would say that if I had to introduce a candidate that I thought didn't get enough buzz, but is someone that I thought is a strong contestant, I would say Tammy from Syracuse, house flipper, weightlifter, jiu-jitsu person. I think, right, they showed her like flipping somebody over as well.
Yes, correct.
Tammy from Syracuse, dark horse candidate.
All right, so Tammy's your Dave Tobe. Generally, the Bachelor, Bachelorette cycles go like the Cleveland Browns. They're on to the next in a year or so. Peter is hoping he finds his Bill Belichick. But then 20 years in, could be speculating about their future anyway. So nothing is guaranteed in football or in love, Connor.
I was going to ask you another question, but that's the perfect way to end this. There's just really no other way to end this. That was absolutely perfect.
Well, we'll cut to the credits then. Thanks, Connor. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Jenny Vrentis, and Connor Orr. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Moravik is emeritus executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.